Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Phil M. from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Lauren, for asking me to come out and the group. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
Sobriety date, May 21st, 2007. One of many dates that I had prior to that, living in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and other fellowships, trying to get sober. And even if it was one day I thought that I wanted to get sober, and the next day I was thinking it's a good idea to take a drink or whatever else I want to put in my body or materialistic thing to make me feel better. I grew up in typical home. What I look at is now is like the alcoholic mind make everything look good on the outside, but I still feel like everything's falling apart on the inside. My parents did the best they could. At the time when I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would tell you much different. I'd say my parents don't like me, I hate them, and they want to get in the way of anything that I want to do. They don't want to see me succeed. Many things that I would put up that would be reasons why I would continue to drink. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous around the age of 12. My dad was in Karen Foundation, and I had gone out to visit him, and I remember going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting there on a Sunday with him. We had some kind of like picnic thing. It was in May sometime. Remember hearing the guy speak up there, and it became very clear that I wanted to consume alcohol or live that lifestyle, because I was, as the attention span that I have at 12 years old, a lot of the stuff the person that was speaking at the on the stage up there, sitting at this desk, I remember quite clearly. I don't remember a whole lot at age 12, but I do remember that. And I remember him talking about partying, and people are laughing, and I thought, like, that sounds like it's going to be a good time. And later on in recovery, I shared that with somebody, and they made a joke of it and said, well, your dad quit drinking, so you had to pick up where he left off and continue the family tradition. And I didn't look at it like that at the time, whether or not that's what happened or not. But I do know, like, my dad being an alcoholic, and that has nothing to do with my alcoholism. It has nothing to do with why I chose to drink. And all the stuff that, like, happened in my life throughout up into that time, like, because I was, my, like I said, it looked good on the outside. My mom took me to church every Sunday, went to Sunday school, went to catechism class, snuck out back of catechism class with smoked cigarettes, you know, because that was the cool thing to do. Remember having issues with, what I blamed it on at the time was depression. Looking for something outside of myself. So I remember going to some doctor because, you know, I'm depressed because dad's not around. He's going to AA all the time. And, even before that, even when he had drank, I'd be home, he'd be sleeping, and I didn't grow up in a violent household. It was mostly like dad was passed out, me and my brother were like to fend for ourselves and do what we needed to do, eat and do whatever, and mom was working at night because she was home during the day to get us off to school, and my dad was there to get us home from school. Somewhere around getting in trouble with the law, getting arrested, all kinds of things that happened with behaviors that I wanted to do when I was 12. Because vandalism made me feel good. That was cool to do, to destroy stuff. And stealing, that made me feel good because I could get something that I wanted to get. And all that stuff, like it was always something to make me feel good. And alcohol was a little harder to get when I was 12. I had a friend down the street. We were drinking, we'd put it in Gatorade bottles, Yuengling Black and Tan. And I would drink it warm. And it wasn't all that great. I didn't have that great of experience with it. I didn't have like this, oh wow, like I'm going to continue to drink. It wasn't until a little bit later that year that I got some vodka and blacked out, and that's when I knew that I didn't feel anything that I was feeling, like any of the aloneness, any of the different from everyone else that's in the room with me. Because I don't even know, maybe even earlier than age 10, somewhere in third grade, like I learned to manipulate and that I didn't have to do my schoolwork. And the teacher was going to give me the answers, and I got put in the slow learning class. So then that was like another thing on the notch on the belt to say, okay, well, I'm different than everyone else. So, you know, I don't fit in. And this was a lot of my action just because I wanted to do what I wanted to do. So like I said, trouble with the law, and they sent me to some counselors, and you know, before you know it, I'm got some medications, and alcohol is hard to get, so I'm getting some other substances to make me feel good, because it's a lot easier to get other stuff than it is alcohol when you're not 21. And plus, I mean, if you look at it the way I did, I looked at it as like, if I got to buy Joe a bottle of booze and I get a bottle of booze, or I can go buy a bag of something and keep that all for myself, that's what I was going to do, because I didn't have a whole lot of money at the age 12. It wasn't until I turned 21, maybe 20, like when I really started drinking, because I was able to go into the bars at 20, and a lot of local bars around here, like they didn't, like I hung out with older people, living a different lifestyle. Doing whatever I could to fit in, because I always thought that I didn't fit in. And if it was like having it myself, the one of the things that like was like a big trigger in my addiction was the euphoria you get when you have like two pagers, a cell phone at 15, and everybody's calling you on a Friday night. And really, like, once I got locked up, like, none of those people sent me money or anything. None of them bothered to call me. None of them were there for me at all. It was just that I enjoyed it when I was home. And for some reason, I always went back to that lifestyle. I always, like, whenever I came out of lockup, I didn't go to any of the dry goods stuff. I always went to the alcohol, because I always got locked up at the part where it was, things were bad and I was using other chemicals. So in my mind, I was always like, well, if I just drink alcohol. And at that point of 17, I ended up in my first rehab, and due to some chemicals that I was using, because I was on probation at the time, and they were giving all these, I had to go twice a week and give tests, so I was trying to figure out. And being on probation at that time for me was like, I was learning more and more how to continue to drink and use whatever else I could, because at least the people that I hung out with there was all trying to manipulate the system. And I was trying to get around and see what I could do to get by. Went on for another few years, and somewhere in December of 2001, I remember that that month quite queer. Like, lots of drinking. Within a month time, 3 DUIs. And I remember going in and sitting in Bucks County. I was there for a short period of time. No real jail time at this point yet. And I remember sitting there, and I'd go to this group, this 12-step book group, and it was on a Monday night. Guy Bill McDonald was there, and he'd always go over the first three steps. So every week it was step one, then step two, then step three, and then go back to step one, step two. And I remember the week that we were talking about acceptance, and I'd been to rehab before. I didn't want what you guys had. I mean, I wanted the gifts that you get from sobriety, but I didn't want to be sober. I wanted to have, like, be able to still drink, but be able to live a good, productive life. I could never seem to get that to align it with itself. But I remember talking, and I shared that night what pushed me to put my hand up that night, but we were talking about acceptance, and the biggest thing that I knew about acceptance at the time, that I was accepted that I'm going to be an alcoholic and I'm going to come in and out of these institutions the rest of my life. Or maybe I'll die if I'm lucky. Because for me, like, the drinking and whatever else it was like a cowardly way of suicide. Like, because I'm, like, putting all this poison in my body. I'm consuming as much as I can till I don't remember what's going on. And that's pretty much the way I wanted to be all the time. Like, my motto was at the time is, like, I remember, like, not being able to function without a buzz. And my mind was so delusional that, like, that's what I thought, like, everybody else was doing, too. Like, everybody drinks. Everybody's, like, all my friends, the people that I hung out with at the time, they were all drinkers. Now, mind you, I didn't go hang out with people that didn't drink. So I'm sure they were there. I just didn't choose to hang out with them. I chose people that were doing what I was doing because I did try to hang out with some people that didn't drink, but they were like a buzzkill because they're like telling you, like, yo, you're drinking too much, you're doing too much of this, you know. I'm like, boy, this person's getting in the way of what I want to do. I can't hang out with them. And there were some things that I remember when I first picked up that drink and drank the hard alcohol. I remember doing whatever else with friends and saying, I'm never going to do that stuff. I'm never going to do this. And it's never going to get that bad. And it did get that bad. And it got continued to get worse. Had a whole slew of stuff of legal troubles for about a year and a half. And remember it took me out. They gave me, I don't know if it was like 23 months parole for those DUIs. And I remember getting that in February of 2001 when I finally got sentenced. And it took me until January of 2006 to get off of probation or parole for 23 months. And it was constant violating, constantly trying to manipulate the system, constantly. And telling my caseworker or whatever I called him at the time that I was an alcoholic and I needed to go to rehab always got me out of going to jail. So always I was trying to manipulate some way that was going to somewhat live my life to be comfortable to some degree. And my dad would take me to meetings and, like, tell me to go talk to some people. And I would talk to him. But I didn't really tell him what was going on because why would I tell him that? Like, I still want to drink. Like, I don't want what you got. Like, really? You guys are boring and, like, drink coffee at a meeting at 8 o'clock at night. Like, and you hang out in churches. Like, hey, I didn't like going to church when I was younger and then got confirmed. Why would I want to do this later on in life? But I was very closed-minded at the time. So I continued to do what I needed to do, and a few overdoses, and in and out of treatment. Many of resolutions on, like, because towards the last 2 years of my use, there was some clear days that I was like, man, this is it. Like, I got to stop now. Like, it's getting bad. Like, and then that would only last for a short period of time. Like, and it would be gone. And I'd be back right in it again. The girlfriend that I had at the time, probably like 3 years, I spent a whole, like, maybe 6 months with her over the times of being in and out of institutions and stuff. And the one time I came home and thought, well, if we have a kid, you know, I'll be able to get sober, and, you know, because I'm going to have to be a dad now, and I'm going to have a job and all this stuff. Now, mind you, I didn't have the job. I was living in an apartment she was paying for. Like, I wasn't a productive member of anything. Like, maybe going in and out of jail, that's what I was productive to do. And I was like, I was real good at doing that. And the thing was, is like, I remember calling one of the guys from AA when I was in jail, because, you know, I like I said before, I couldn't call any of my friends I was partying with. They didn't have money or wasn't going to accept my call, because I didn't have nothing for them. But I could call somebody from AA. And I remember calling this guy, and he's like, how you feeling? I was like, man, I feel better than I've ever did in my life. And he asked me, do you know why that is? And I said, no, not really. He goes, well, you're not waking up every morning trying to figure out where you're going to get your next drink. And I didn't think of it that way ever. But I did feel, I felt great. No depression medicines. No, I mean, when you're doing uppers and downers and everything else, and you go talk to the psychiatrist, and then sometimes I'd even go and drink before I went to meet with the psychiatrist. And like, sometimes I'd sit there in the office and like sit there and cry to him, like, and tell him all this crazy stuff. And I look back at it now, I'm like, man, like, I can't believe like these people didn't like throw me out and like see through what I was doing. But I mean, I guess it's their job. They probably knew exactly what I was doing. And just like sitting working with another alcoholic, we can't force them to change their life. Like there was no way. Like, you could tell me all kinds of stuff of what I needed to do and how I needed to change my life, but it wasn't clicking then yet. But I had my son was born, and gave me a little bit of a motive to like think to change my life. And I went to Penn Foundation right down the road from here. One of the few rehabs that were close to home. Because if it was either treatment, psychiatric, or jail where I was at for at least 7 years. I just threw all that life away. Like, and the way life is today is like, wow, I can't believe like it was like that. But I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't be like able to have the experience that I had if I hadn't gone through that. And not to say that was the way to go. So I was in Penn and went out to an AA meeting, and right away when I went there, I had to go see the psychiatrist, and he's telling me I need to take X, Y, and Z for this thing and whatever else is going on, and anxiety and everything else. And at that point in my use, I was using, like I said, uppers, downers, as much alcohol as I can get into my body, like anything. Anything to get me to feel better. And I remember that what they asked me, like, what's your choice of drink or drug? And I just said more. Like anything and everything to get me out of self. And looking at it now, that's like not what normal people do, but I thought that was normal. Like, that was a good answer to give the guy at the time. And like I said, he wanted to give me all kinds of medications. And I remember having the conversation with him that I'm not feeling suicidal right now, but if I feel suicidal, I'll come see you. And I'm only, and based that decision off of the experience that I had when I was in the prison system. Like, I felt good when I was in there. And later on, once going through some of the step work with somebody, I came to discover that it was like I wasn't running my life when I was in there. They pretty much unlocked the door and told me when I can come out, when I had to eat. They had a whole schedule like of what I had to do. They had like room service. They did your laundry, slid it under the door. Like, I mean, it's, I guess it's accommodating if you want to live that life. So it went out to a meeting, and I remember listening to this gentleman up front, and whatever it was, I remember that in one of the days in groups or something, they said about getting a sponsor, and I had a sponsor before, but I wasn't trying to go through the steps. I just had a sponsor to call a sponsor, and we'd go and read some stuff out of like the 12 and 12 and stuff, and I later came to found out that was just a book of essays that Bill wrote later on, and the real work is in the first 164 pages in the big book, and I really didn't know anything about the big book till I met this guy Chris after the meeting. I went up and talked to him, and I said, "Hey, I need a sponsor around the area. It sounds like I can relate with some of the stuff, like, well, you know, anything." I talked to him, felt out of place, and he shared some stuff about some, like, his experiences with different medications, and that's where I was. I was, like, thinking to myself, like, I asked him the question, and I said, because at this point, I was, like, willing to do stuff to get my life on track, because my son was going to be one soon, in another few months, and I still haven't gotten this, got a job, have a place to live, being a dad, being supportive to my family, none of that stuff. I remember telling Chris, I'm like telling him all this stuff, and he says, "How do you feel right now?" And I'm like, "Well," said, "I'm trouble sleeping at night right now. You know, I trying to think about like all the stuff that I did that got me here, like what I got to do to get out of here, what I got to do when I get home, the job I got to get when I get home, and the bills I got to pay and make restitution for whatever it was." And I didn't use restitution. I just figured I owed money to people, and I got to straighten this stuff out. And in those thoughts, like, as I told him all that stuff, sobriety wasn't one of the things I mentioned. I just needed to do all that stuff. And he told me he could share with me a different solution in life, and a solution that was shared with him. And I kind of was like confused with it. I was like, "All right, a solution." I'm like, "I don't know. What are you even talking about?" I mean, at that point, I was in and out of rehabs, but I must have missed something. I didn't hear nothing about a solution. And I look at it, it's like I wasn't willing to hear any of that. Like, none of that stuff. Like I would read the steps off the wall, like, here and read them and pick and choose, like, stuff that I wanted to do. And I wasn't really there for anyone else but just not to go to jail or not to get my parents off my back or whatever it was, so I can manipulate them so they can pay for my attorneys so I could not go to jail and stuff and all kinds of stuff and along those lines. Then Chris talked to me. He said, what he experienced, he said, he talked to me about being restless, irritable, and discontent. And I didn't know that's what he was telling me to read some of the stuff in this. What he was giving me, the first direction was to go home and back to the treatment center that was my home and read the doctor's opinion. But what he told me, he said, "You feel this way, restless, irritable, discontent, without taking a drink." And I'm like, "Wow, yeah." And what it came down to is, like, the only time I didn't feel that way was when I had drink or any other substance in my body. I'm skipping around here a minute, but I think this is pretty important in my story about, like, I got burned in a fire. Now, that's not much in importance, but I got a lawsuit settlement out of it, and I got a good chunk of change for a person at 18. And my thought at 18, when I went into rehab at 17, I was like, all right, I'm going to not drink and drug because I want to get a car, I want to get a place to live, and I want to get somewhere in life and go to college. So I enrolled in college, and that didn't last too long, but because got in the way of doing other stuff. And so I bought the new car, bought a lot of new clothes. I felt good for a while. I was able to stay sober for about between 60 and 90 days. I didn't really count. But I remember I was in this group, some Visions group up in Allentown for youth. And I was doing okay in there. I didn't do no step work, didn't do none of that stuff. But, like, the part that, like, that I wanted to share was, like I can get all that stuff, all that external stuff, and I only feel good for a short period of time. So, like, the whole time, if it wasn't something that I was putting in my body, it was, like I said, it's some external things that can make me feel okay for a period of time. And so not much transpired that night, the first night talking to Chris, and other than he asked me to call him when I was done reading that doctor's opinion. And at this point in my life, like, my parents had, like, kind of said, hey, we're not coming to see you, we're not talking to you, until you get yourself together. And I call Chris, and he says, so did you read it? I said, yeah. He said, all right. He goes, well, read it a couple more times. I'll be there Sunday to see you. I'm like, all right, I'm going to get a visit in rehab. All right. Like, I never. And I thought it weird a little bit. I'm like, why would this guy want to take time out of his life? He don't even know who I am, and he's going to visit me. My family won't even come visit me right now. I didn't get what he was doing. And I remember going out to the park bench, and one of the first things he said to me, he goes, you know, Bill, he said, I'm going to sit down with you. We're going to go over this stuff here. And if it doesn't help you, he goes, at least it's going to help me out. I was like, well, that's pretty kind of, like, ignorant to say. I'm like, why the hell is he telling me this? And so we sat down, and we read the doctor's opinion, and he asked me what, like, stuck out in there. And I definitely could, like, from the first moment he told me about the restless irritable discontent, that was, like, my life, and without a drink in me. And I could only hang on to that for so long before I needed to put something into me or do something to make me feel better. Heck, it could have been even stealing something to make me feel better for a brief moment. So we started going to the first step, and I thought already, I'm like, well, we're moving pretty quick here, because I tried some stuff in another fellowship, and I had this, like, workbook I had to write in, and I'm like, aren't we doing this here a little quick? And he's like, no. He goes, how long do you want to stay sick? That's what he asked me. And I can't remember exactly, like, the words he put it in. He said, if you have a broken arm and you need a cast for the summer, and you might have 6 weeks that you have to have this cast on, or you can go the whole summer without it. Your arm's going to heal wrong, and at the end of summer, we're going to have to re-break your arm and get it back into where it needs to go. How do you want to do it? I was like, all right. I guess that's what we're going to go through, some of this step work, and I'll give it a shot. And I was very receptive to listen to what was going on, because I was backed into a corner, and that's always when I'm most receptive, when I'm backed into a corner and I have nowhere to turn, so I got no other options. And so he asked me if my life is unmanageable. The first thing that comes to mind, yeah, my life's manageable. I signed myself into rehab. Like, I'm trying to better myself. He goes, Bill. He goes, people that are managing their lives well do not sign themselves into a treatment center or any kind of facility like this. And it's like, oh, all right, another blow to my ego. Like, I thought like I was giving right answers here. I was, but they were. I had to share with him, like, one of the things he said, I have to answer everything honestly or he's not going to be able to help me. And so that's what we continue to do. And then he asked me the powerlessness over the alcohol. He said, when you pick up, do you know when you're going to put it back down again? And I really don't know at that point. I didn't know when I was going to put it back down. I did know that, like, if the law got in the way, I was able to put it down. And that was the only time I was able to stop. But it wasn't on my own. I didn't stop, like, consciously say, yeah, I'm done, I'm quitting today, and that's it. It didn't go that way. So we got to going over. He's like, all right, well, that's the first step. And I'm like, all right. He's like, all right, well, let's go. We're going to talk about the second step. And we did a little bit more talking in there, but I was like, man, this is really going quick here. And so, yeah, I remember some of these, like, pointer questions he asked me. He said, do you have any insane ideas? Well, I guess, yeah, why not? That's living life on the edge. Like, there's, you got to live life like there's no tomorrow, so I want to live to my fullest today. And he said, well, how about if we go through this stuff here, and would you be willing to believe in something else that could restore you to sanity? And I didn't really know what he was talking about. I had no clue at this point. Like, I guess so. Like, that was the only answer I could say. And he pointed out in the book, where it's written, it says that we only need to make a decision at this point. We don't need to make a life-changing change that, like, okay, I feel God and I know God is in my life. And if you're there, that's awesome. He said, I'm well on my way. If it, like, he pointed, like, a lot of the stuff out in the book, but I wasn't there. Like, even though I went to church every Sunday when I was younger, I didn't have that, like, principle. I had a lot of resentment towards God. At this part of my life, kind of had resentments with AA at that time. Remember my mom giving my dad the ultimatum, if he didn't stop drinking and get sober, she was going to leave. Well, I remember when I was 18, he was sober, going to AA, and she left. So I'm like, well, that didn't work. Like, why? I mean, go to AA and you still lose everything? Like, that don't make sense. And I see my dad hurt over it and everything, and I didn't get it. I didn't know what it was. And I'm like, well, maybe it's my fault for all the stuff that me and my brother are doing. I had that thought go through my head a couple times. So, like, having to have that full faith in God wasn't necessary in the beginning, for me at least. We read the third step prayer, and he pointed out that, and I'm sure I had it here in church sometime, but it seemed like it was, like, all new to me. He said that, like, thy means God. And every time I read thy will, thy God is God, God's will, God's power, and God's way of life. And I'm like thinking, man, how am I going to, this is a tall order to fill here. Like, how am I going to live like the way I'm living today and all of a sudden go to that? And he told me, he said, no, just are you willing to believe that this is here? And are you going to be able to turn your life over to this to the best you can at this time? Not that you did it 100%. And I agreed. Moving forward, he tells me to write a four-step. And this was all in one Sunday afternoon, over a few hours of a visit. And I thought to myself, oh, wow, I can't write a four-step. This is like a lot of stuff. This is going to take forever to do this. Like, and Without even asking Chris, he told me, he said, just write a list of all the people that you hate, all the people you're angry with, and institutions or whatever it is. And just write down the names on a list, and that's all. And on another piece of paper, write a list of your fears. And he said, call me sometime whenever you're finished. And then Chris pretty much left that day. And I called him up in the course of the last 2 weeks that I was there. And I remember asking him once I had that list. And I was like, well, I don't know if I have the whole list written down. I don't know how am I going to write this? Because I don't know if I have everything. And he asked me, he said, do you think you sat there an hour and wrote down everything that you could? He's like, I don't need to hear some made up thing. He goes, I need to get, what we want to do here is get what's in between you and God right now. And what's getting you blocked from your God. And so he said, if you feel that you did a full hour, he said, go to the next column and write why you're angry and resentful or whatever you are towards these institutions or places. And then once you're out of there, we'll sit down and go over this. And that's what we did. I went to his house and remember redoing the third set prayer. And both times I thought it was really weird, like we're kneeling down, reading out of this book. And I'm like, this is really stupid. Like, why are we doing this? Like, I don't have no idea what we're doing. And and the way I see it that it is am I willing to do something different? Am I willing to let this power into my life and put my guard down, like put my like ego out of the way that it's going to be able to be receptive to somebody else's ideas and thoughts. And and doing that four step wasn't really all that bad. I remember reading off like all the different stuff that I had, my parents, my brother, jobs that I had, girlfriend, like all kinds of stuff. And we filled out a column that affects my like ego, my self-esteem, my pride, and financially I wrote down like on some of them. But in all reality, the most important column was that fourth column when I was writing down my part. And I remember when we got to the end of it, he told me to flip it upside down and look at my part and look and see if that resentment would be there with that person. If I wouldn't have done that to them. And that definitely changed my perception and look at like how I harmed others. And now I have an idea of the type of person that I am and when I'm drinking and living that delusional life that I thought was such a wonderful life. So we read over the sixth step, looked at these character defects, asked God to remove them, and there were some I definitely didn't want to let go of, like, you know, and it said in there, like, and my out for that was, like, I still wanted to be able to lie, because, you know, no one tells the truth, like, why would they do that? Like, you always have to make it that it works in your favor, and so I wanted to hang on to that, definitely. That was the biggest one I wanted to hang on to, was being able to not be truthful and honest with anybody. And and my out was, the book tells me, he says, if as long as I'm willing to have that removed, and I was like, yeah, I guess I'm willing to have it removed. I'm just not ready right now. And that got me into some trouble. As soon as he asked me to do, start going out and I had got a list together and started to do an amends. I remember making one amends. It went okay. It was fine. Nothing really extravagant happened with any of the amends that I had, like that pretty much anybody that I had to make amends with, like, everything went well. But that wasn't my first time. When I sat down with Chris, like, I didn't want to do any of the amends because I was like, I'm not talking to the creditors. Like, why? I don't need to talk to them. They'll get their money when they get it. Like, he was telling me all this stuff that I didn't really want to do. And my first resentment with Chris was, he told me, he said, well, Bill, he said, likely what's going to happen, he says, in a lot of cases that I've seen and with me, he goes, if you don't continue to move your feet, you're probably going to pick up a drink again. And I had probably about the longest time sobriety at that time. It was a little over 90 days. And I remember going to meetings and trying to avoid Chris because I don't want to hear about the amends no more. I made two amends and they went well. Like, why wouldn't the rest of them all be okay like that, right? Like, why do I need to go? And some of them is like to immediate family members, and why would they're starting to talk to me, and I don't want to have them, like, all of a sudden I tell them what I did, that I stole something from them or did whatever I did to them and want them not to talk to me because they're back in my life a little bit now. My son is in my life, in and out here and there, and I had a few relapses after that. One other relapse after I sat down with Chris that first time and decided it was not necessary to do my amends. I can guess I can do 10 and 11 because I can. It's like doing my mini four-step, and I can help others and go to the meetings and make coffee or something. And for, like, the next year and a half, I bounced in and out of different fellowships, and I'd come here to AA and be using dry goods, and then that would get too bad, and then I'd go to another fellowship and just drink alcohol because, you know, the dry goods was the problem, so I need to go to that fellowship. I'm, like, hiding out in other different fellowships trying to figure out the real key to life, because that sobriety stuff that we did out of the big book didn't seem to work that good. And but it only didn't work because I wasn't willing. I took my will back. I decided it was upon myself that I was going to run the show again. And he told me clearly in the third step about this whole plan of, like, how I'm turning my life over and how, like, my life run on self-will got me to where I'm sitting that day in rehab when we were going over it. And And then some critical things happened over the next year and a half of that time that I was using. My dad was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And oh, poor me, I'm going to lose my dad. Now I got to use more to get rid of that feeling. Not how can I be there and helpful and supportive to my dad and my family. It's I got to take care of Bill. I got to get me to feel better. And my dad passed. I wasn't, like, too coherent at the funeral. I was out of it. Got some settlement money, and I got to hit a bottom that I never hit before in my life. And whether or not the money was all spent in the right places and what my dad wanted to do, and I look at it as, like, that was, like, the biggest gift my dad gave me. Thank God to this day I'm still sober from that last time in May when I drank. Because I was able to experience some things that I wouldn't have if I and I believe, like, because for the longest time I was, like, trickling, like, in and out, and I never really had, like, a bad bottom. And a bottom's not really like a bottom, because the bottom could be anywhere, like wherever it is. Because I did pick up a drink one time after that, and landed me up back in an institution for 18 months, and from one night of drinking. And when I got out from there, I got back into step work. Remember having a guy come down and talk to me while I was down in the jail, and we were doing step work before I went in, and I asked him, I was like, well, what do I got to do now? Do I got to start all over at the beginning? And he told me no. He said, why would you need to do that? He said, you need to get back in and pick up where you stop. You stop not making amends. And, cause one of the amends before I picked up that last drink when I was I was in a treatment center. I was sober just about a year, June 11th, somewhere in there, I'd gotten sober. And, May 20th, May 19th is somewhere in there is when I went out and drank. And again, I wasn't willing to the fullest ability to do these amends, because what I thought was willing was, he said, all right, pick somebody on the list. So I stole some stuff from this woman's house when I was living there. And he told me to call her and set up a time to make an amends. And the amends went in my mind that I made the phone call. She didn't answer. She was screening the call, knew it was me. I call Greg back and tell him what's going on. And he goes, well, because I was telling him, like, clearly I did my part. He said, no, you're going to need to leave a message. And shortly after that, he asked me again, how did that go? Did you get a hold of the woman yet? And I decided it was a good idea to take a drink that day. And why not celebrate? I'm coming up on a year of sobriety, or sabotage stuff that's when life is going good, because I'm good at that too. So when I got out that time from those 18 months, when I was in there, he told me, like I said, to keep going, doing what I'm doing, and help other alcoholics. And that's helped me in so much of my life. Like, the prayer and meditation, like, came over time. Like, it took me a few, at least for the alcoholic I am, like, to be receptive to do that thing and be, I don't know, conditioned, whatever it is, to be able to get up in the morning and do daily readings. Like, it took me a little while. It wasn't something that I was real apt to do and jump right in and, like, this is what I got to do every day. And I tried it, and it got old. And what I had to do was start reading other spiritual readings. I had to keep my mind open to other readings of a positive, and it can be any positive reading. Because in my mind, I was like, all right, I have to read this AA daily reflections every day. And after 3 days of 3 years of reading it, it was like reading the same thing over and over again, and I'm not allowing myself to grow. And I didn't come up with that myself. Someone had to tell me that. They're like, Bill, you're not able to grow. Your growth has stopped. And and a lot of things that are going on in my life today, like I'm able to have the same job for almost 11 years now. Like, before, like, I wasn't trying to work for anybody. Like, I worked for myself, like, doing what I wanted to do, because I could work my own hours. Like, stay up all night, maybe go to sleep if I want to, maybe stay awake all week, I don't know, whatever I wanted to do. Whatever I could do to drink more, that was what I needed to do. But now I go to sleep, and sometimes it's like ready to go to sleep whenever. Like, it, you can sit down and fall asleep. Like, it, that was unheard of. I got sober and I thought life was going to be boring. I mean, I got 3 kids now and a wife, and life is not boring. I do have the gift that God gave me to be a father to my son and have full custody of him. That was a long road in itself, like, just able to get visitation of him. And a lot of things that happened in sobriety that I wouldn't wish upon anybody, like going to get visitation for your kid and not gonna being able to see him. And it's all due to my actions prior to that. And I remember, like, when I went to go see an attorney to file paperwork, and I remember sending the paperwork out, and I remember a few days later I'm getting a call from Children's U saying that I'm sexually abusing my son. Because she was going to lose something that she didn't want to lose. And at that point in my life, like, things were really awesome. Life was really good. And I'm like, why did God drop me off here, and why is this happening now? And I remember calling a friend in the program and telling him what's going on in my life, and I told him I got to figure this out. And he said, Bill, did you do this? I said, no. And he said, well, you don't have to figure nothing out. He said, you got to keep helping God's kids and not worry about this. And so true. Like, doing 12-step work, like, and it doesn't even have to be like in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, my son's in Scouts, and they're always looking for volunteers there, and so I can volunteer there, because I have to be a part of my family. And one of the things, once I started, my kids started to get older, and I wasn't able to go to a meeting 7 days a week. I asked this old timer, I said to him, I said, I'm feeling a little like questionable, like if I'm gonna like slip or something, or if like sobriety's not gonna go well for me. And he said, Bill, he said, I can go to a meeting every day. He goes, I'm older. He said, did you get sober to live in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, are you doing what's outlined in the big book? Are you helping other alcoholics? Are you going to God when something's going on wrong in your life? And I had to think about that part. Am I going to God when there's something wrong in my life? Like I said before, sometimes I have to get backed into a corner, still so sober, to take a look at like my actions and what I'm doing. And especially being a positive husband in a relationship, like I wasn't all grown up, like I like very demeaning to a woman. Like I didn't care. Like I just wanted what I wanted. And like, if you weren't hanging out tonight, I'm going to go out and drink and find somebody else. And like, to be able to learn how to live with somebody and love somebody for who they are is like totally not what I was looking at in life before I got here. The unconditional love I got to give my kids, like, Alcoholics Anonymous, like, showed me that life. Showed me the biggest thing was, like, carrying the message to another alcoholic. Like, I'm not thinking about Bill. And it's helped so many times. Like, remember when I stopped smoking cigarettes? Like, that was, like, a big thing. Like, I was like, all right, how the heck am I going to do this? And I applied the principles in 12 steps from Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, so many things, like, these 12 steps have helped me. It just wasn't putting down a drink, because when I got sober, Chris clearly said to me, he said, do you have a drinking problem? And I said, yeah. He said, Bill, you sure you have a drinking problem? He said, are you able to go to the bar and order a drink? Are you able to consume and put stuff into your body? He said, are you able to stay sober? I said, no. He said, well, maybe you have a sobriety problem. And that's where what I have to look at and continue to grow in, like, spiritually and mentally, even as life goes on. Like, reading a lot of God books and stuff, like, that's, like, one of the big things. I know it's like, you know, oh, no, God, like, and a lot of stuff that, and it's taken the past 2-3 years, like, of reading this stuff, and to be able to, like, even be willing to expand into, like, the God of my understanding. And the good thing is that, like, the readings that I'm able to find, like, is not telling me I have to believe this to understand, like, what's going on in life. I have to come to an understanding and be able to trust and love my God and know that He's caring unconditionally. And like, coming to this meeting here, I used to come here a lot, and I remember just coming to this room and when I was newly sober and knowing that God was in the room. And when I knew God was in the room was when I heard someone share up in the front there some hope in their life. And God was as big as the hope in my life, and that's all I got.